KQED.
From KQED-FM, this is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Next on the program, a conversation with award-winning science fiction writer, poet, children's book author, and essayist Ursula K. Le Guin, whose newest book is called The Telling. Ursula Le Guin joins us next, and you're invited, immediately following news from National Public Radio. From KQED-FM in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of our program. One of the most prolific and widely read writers in North America, Ursula K. Le Guin, received the Hugo and Nebula Awards for the science fiction novel The Left Hand of Darkness and the National Book Award for the children's book The Farthest Shore. A writer of science fiction novels, short fiction, essays, poetry, and children's books, she is the daughter of distinguished anthropologist A.L. Kroeber and writer Theodora Kroeber, and was born right here in Berkeley. In fact, her brother, Ted Kroeber, a friend of mine, taught many years at San Francisco State in the psychology department. And one of her other brothers, Carl Kroeber, was a professor of mine at the University of Wisconsin. He's now at Columbia. Her other well-known novels include The Dispossessed, The World for World is Forest, and Always Coming Home. And her newest novel is The Telling. It takes place on the planet Akka, a once low-tech world transformed into a regimented industrialized society run by corporation men who have tried to essentially annihilate history. The protagonist, a woman from Earth by the name of Sudi, travels 70 years to get to Akka and winds up searching not only for the planet's past, but her own as well. We're delighted to have Ursula Le Guin with us. Nice to see you again. Good morning.
Good morning.
Maybe we ought to start off as talking a little bit about history with the emphasis on story. It's not a science, but an art, you say. And let's talk about how that ties in with at least finding oneself and finding one's own past in a collective sense.
History we're talking about.
You're married to a historian, in fact. Right?
I am, so I have to be careful. What I say about history.
I think this is a novel about history.
Yeah. Well, it's about remembering.
Yeah.
And disremembering. And Milan Kundera called organized forgetting. That kind of thing, which does seem to be one of the big questions of our time, one of the big issues of our time. If you live in the Soviet Union, are you going to forget communism? Going to forget 70 years of that, you know, that sort of thing. They're interesting questions.
They're the imponderables in some ways the most interesting questions. But it's as if we are constantly kind of finding what our history is in different ways. It's interesting that you mentioned Kundera because there's kind of an editing process in memory where we edit out to sort of accommodate our own feelings or to accommodate the new novel suggests that the state can play a very pivotal, instrumental, and strongly repressive role in this, and often does.
Yes, I think all states do. All regimes do. Because also, you know, it can be a theocracy or a political regime, whatever, where you remember selectively. And then, of course, we do it to ourselves. And that's... So I sort of... What I have in this book is a person who's been very badly hurt, and in a sense can't handle her own memories, coming to a world which is in the process of being very badly hurt, having its sort of collective memories stamped out and replaced with essentially a new myth, a myth of progress, of eternal progress towards the stars.
There's a sense in some of the people who have been reviewing your book that this is an allegory about either the Soviet Union or particularly communist China and its relationship to Taoism. But I kept seeing glimmerings of our own nation in this.
Well, I do hope it's not an allegory because I hate allegories. But it's certainly...
Wait, why do you hate allegories?
Oh, you know, this is that... A means B.
Oh, but it doesn't have to be. Allegorical can be much richer than
metaphorical.
That. Yeah.
Allegory tends to be one-to-one, whereas metaphor is kind of inexhaustible. And so I hope I write metaphorically, not allegorically.
You do write. For me, you write metaphorically, although one of our local reviewers, David Kippen, in fact, the book editor of the San Francisco Chronicle.
He read it as an allegory.
Yeah.
And I sort of thought, well, fair enough. Apparently, he sort of already knew everything that I was trying to write about. And it wasn't news to him. So he saw it as just sort of that I was writing an allegory. And to me, it was much more a process of discovery because where the book started, it did start with a specific event. I went to a meeting about Taoism. And I've sort of worked on Taoism, philosophical Taoism, all my life. I translated Lao Tzu and so on. I didn't know a thing about the religion, Taoism, the actual practice of this millennial religion in China, a popular religion. It has very little to do, basically, with the works of Lao Tzu and Zhuang Tzu. It's a popular religion. It's all mixed up with Buddhism. Everything China seems to get mixed up together, you know. Anyway, this has been going on for maybe 3,500 years. And when Mao Zedong came along, essentially, he seems to have suppressed that religion within 20 or 30 years. He managed to pretty well wipe out the practice of Taoism in China. Well, this was completely news to me. You know, if you knew that, then it's sort of an old story. But to me, it was this monstrous event had happened during my lifetime. And then even more monstrous to me was the fact that I hadn't known it, that a religion, a world-sized religion, can disappear without my even... I didn't know it was there.
So you did more research and found out the story or the history of this?
No, not very much, because it's so hard to find out what's going on in China. And I know very little about modern China. And I figured, you know, that's what I would have done if I weren't a novelist. But being a novelist, what I did was go home and brood about it, and it went down into my unconscious, and it started coming up as a story.
Why science fiction?
Because of the metaphorical possibilities. Because I didn't have to write about China, for instance, which I couldn't do. I don't know enough about China. I don't know Chinese. I don't.
But you know Akka.
But I know Akka.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, I think once you said that science fiction is more realism. That's not fantasy.
To me, yeah. It's just a way of writing realism. Yeah. Fantasy is something else.
Explain the difference as you see it. I mean, just like you did nicely with allegory and metaphor.
Well, science fiction is, I think, a sort of branch of realism. It takes off from what really is and extrapolates from it or puts it in metaphorical terms. But it does not deny anything. It doesn't deny the way the world works now. Whereas fantasy, which is much older and comes from a deeper place in the imagination, ultimately, I think. Fantasy changes the ground rules in order to arrive at truth. But, you know, in science fiction, if you have flying cats, you have to explain how they were genetically altered so as to fly. In fantasy, you just have flying cats.
What is it with you and cats, by the way?
I like cats, and I like the idea of flying cats, too.
Yeah, but I mean, you've written books about cats, and you've been drawn to cats, or the feline, for quite some time now.
Let's see, don't all my cat books, they all have wings, don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah,
okay, as far
well,
as I know,
I'm drawn to winged cats.
The winged cats, yes.
Yes, yes. Well, I have a feeling that if cats could have wings, they would. See, that's fantasy.
Yeah, that's very nicely put, and indeed it is fantasy. You don't mind being called a science fiction writer then? I mean, because I remember Harlan Ellison almost jumped across the console when he was describing as a science fiction writer. I mean, because you do write so many other things. You write children's books and essays and poetry and so forth.
Yeah. I like the fact that I've written realistic books to be taken into account. I hate to be sort of labeled the sci-fi writer, you know. Because I feel like, basically, I'm a novelist. You know, I write any kind of novel that I'm able to write.
Science fiction does seem to get a kind of short shrift, though. Certainly in the academy, it's regarded
it's used as a put-down.
Metafiction or something, you know, too popularized.
Genre,
yeah.
Yes.
But kind of a genre that's not taken seriously.
It's funny they use a French word as a put-down. Well, all genre is inferior to literature. There, I mean, that's the distinction, really? Literature and genre fiction, which I think is just very hokey. Because literature, in other words, means realism, basically. And realism is another genre. So then where are you? You haven't made any statements about quality. You've merely made statements about kind. And the differences are very interesting. I mean, I like being able to write realism and science fiction and fantasy. And if I could write westerns, I would, you know.
You've also become categorized or labeled or genreized or something as a feminist writer, particularly after Left Hand of Darkness.
I accept that happily, yes. I am a feminist writer.
In fact, you said you described that whole process of writing that novel as an early experiment in deconstructing gender.
Mm-hmm. That was the game at the moment. We were all sort of staring at each other and saying, well, what does it mean to be a man and what does it mean to be a woman? And realizing we didn't know, and we still don't, really, how much of it is biological, how much of it is constructed by social custom and demand. And we're still working on that one.
You worked on an essay, which I think is a very memorable essay, and so much of your work is memorable, but about just the whole process of trying to imagine a woman as a writer, to imagine a woman, you know, a room of one's own, or you came up with a fisherwoman, you know, going into the unconscious sort of and, you know, getting
it was Virginia Woolf's fisherwoman, actually. Yes. And so mine was her daughter, me being a sort of granddaughter, actually.
Virginia Woolf gave us Shakespeare's sister. You gave us Virginia Woolf's daughter. That's right.
Well, Virginia Woolf's fisherwoman's daughter,
right.
Yeah.
Fisherwoman's daughter.
She described a writer as this fisherwoman sitting, dropping a line into her unconscious, and, you know, and then sort of catching a fish. And what a lovely image. And just the idea of a fisherwoman rather than a fisherman was kind of sweet.
You're also working with this whole idea. In fact, a famous essay by Erica Jong that I think was written after yours about the artist as housewife and the idea of this, you know, if you can't have babies, you can't write books. Or, I mean, babies if, or if, books. It's like
babies
one
or, books,
or the other.
Books
yeah.
or babies, yes. Yeah. It's a strange myth there. Yeah, very strange.
You are here to tell us that both can be done.
So Margaret Atwood has been great about that. She said, you know, if you have to be a woman writer, it's best to be dead.
She was just here on Thursday, actually. We didn't talk about this, but I'd like to talk about it some more with you. In fact, you quote the infamous remark of Norman Mailer's about work writers need balls. And I,
the only thing a writer needs is balls. Yeah, I love it.
I asked him about that, his temperature rose perceptibly. And he said, why is it that some people keep, because Francine Prosa just quoted him as saying that. And he said, why is it some people keep, you say something, they keep hitting you with it over and over and over again. He obviously has disowned it or tried to disown it to some extent.
Well, I'm kind of glad he was wriggling. It's like he still doesn't get it. He maybe hasn't noticed that women don't have balls. Could it be? Could it? No.
Well, if cats can have wings, why?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, in some of my worlds, actually, we have arrangements of that kind.
Now, a lot of women certainly are accused of having that in a psychic sense.
Go to my Left Hand of Darkness book and you will find, essentially, women with balls.
That's right. Yes. Women are still excluded. You still, I guess this figure keeps coming up in relation to your observation about 90% of the canon, or what we call the canon, is still male.
Yeah, actually, I think Atwood was wrong about if you want to be a woman writer, be dead, because women, as soon as they die, women writers get dropped from the canon. We include living women, but it is amazing how fast the academic critical canon tends to drop women. And so, therefore, the laborious process that feminism had to go through in the 70s and 80s of digging up, reinstating women writers, such as Willa Cather, who had just been sort of quietly eased off into marginality, and saying, wait a minute, this is a central writer. And, of course, they're forever trying to marginalize Virginia Woolf. This is an ongoing process. But these are writers who are central to the whole 20th century novel. You know, we can't marginalize them. It's an odd process.
It's changed, though, and it certainly is
changing.
In the process of changing more. Yeah.
Things are better than they were. They definitely are. There's much more assumption of equity, I think.
Even if not equity in the reality that we should have equity?
No, well, You got a long way to go, baby. Yeah.
Talking to Ursula Le Guin, whose new novel is The Telling. Tell us a little bit about your story, your history. I mean, Berkeley is sort of where it all began. And you were writing at 9 years old? Is that
right? Oh, I was writing.
Even before that?
As soon as I learned how to hold the pen, I guess. Yeah, right. Yes, I always wrote. Yeah, I went to Berkeley High and suffered through Berkeley High. And then sort of just through a fluke, my father taught for a year at Harvard, so I got to go to Radcliffe free. So I went to Radcliffe, not even knowing what Radcliffe was.
This is an assumption.
That was kind of fun.
Because for a Berkeley girl, I imagine it was more than fun. It was a whole world opening up, wasn't it?
It was great because, and it was important to me that I think, as I look back, that it was a woman's college then. It was, Radcliffe was a little wart sort of on the side of Harvard, this enormous male school. But it was a happy little wart that got the best of Harvard, and yet you could sort of go home and be among women and have that experience, which is very important, I do believe, for many young women, of being truly among their peers and choosing male companionship, but not sort of having to be in a man's world all the time. And it is a man's world, and it's very much a man's world at Harvard. Boy. The testosterone level there is pretty high, students and faculty both. So Radcliffe really was a great place. I'm very sorry to say that the college no longer exists. It finally got absorbed by Harvard.
But you grew up with a very strong woman. I mean, as a model, one would presume, your mother?
And my great aunt. Mm-hmm. There were two strong women in my household, yes. Yeah. And then three older brothers and interesting pa, so that was a good balance.
There's the assumption, because your father was this anthropologist who did all this work with the Native Americans, that somehow that had a, particularly with novels of yours like Always Coming Home, which I think you've described as your most California book, that was the influence of your father?
I don't know. There's a sort of anthropological slant to a lot of my books. For instance, in The Telling, Sudie, who goes to this world, Akka, is essentially in the position of an anthropologist. She's there to gather information about a culture or a society, which is kind of like being an anthropologist, right? And like many anthropologists, field workers, particularly in the past, she's essentially alone among another people. And this is a very common situation in my books. Now, I don't know where I got that. I mean, I guess I knew my dad was going off doing field work, but I didn't know what it meant when I was 10. So I don't know quite where this comes from.
Maybe where that fisherwoman's line and hook and
maybe
sinker is.
Maybe it's genetic.
And so forth.
I mean, who knows?
Another thing that's come up recently with all this excitement about Harry Potter, your name keeps surfacing. Tolkien's too, but you know, I mean, there's David Kippen was who suggested that perhaps Rowling, you know, the word derivative might be used even somewhat.
I was a little taken aback when people were rushing up to me for a while and saying, "Have you read this wonderful book? She's so original. She invented a school for wizards." And I sort of, I thought I'd done that in 1967, you know. So I guess things have to be rediscovered every generation.
How does that make you feel, though? I mean, particularly given this enormous success.
I tell you what grieves me is in so many of the reviews of the Harry Potter books show such a depth of ignorance on the part of the reviewer of the whole tradition out of which those books come. The whole fantasy tradition,
the mythic
wizards and stuff,
and
even English school stories. Yes. I mean, those books are just English school stories. I thought people who knew anything about Kitty Lit knew the English school story tradition. The American reviewers don't seem to know any of this stuff, and they seem to think that she invented fantasy, you know. I know she doesn't think that.
As the English would say, they're bloody ignorant, many of them, alas.
And how can they be so ignorant of what the kids read? And what grown-ups read, too, I mean, because fantasy remains profoundly popular.
Have you read any of the Harry Potter novels?
I So I sort of read at the first one, and just I thought it was cute. It's a cute book.
What do you make of this? Like Harold Bloom and Hugh Kenner going at it, locking horns. Harold Bloom saying these books are worthless. Stylistically, they're dreadful and putrid. And Hugh Kenner defending Ms. Rowling and saying, no, she writes well and, you know, she's enchanting and all that.
I think I would have to say, being sort of outside the fray, that this is an epiphenomenon of super hyper popularity that probably has very little to do with the real nature of the books. But once something becomes, you know, a massive bestseller of this kind, then it's going to have detractors and defenders. It all seems a little bit beside the point to me. I just hope, what I hope is that that some of these people, since such a fuss has happened, strangely enough, about these, what seem to me fairly conventional fantasies, that it will send some people who should have known better back to read Tolkien, for instance, who I do think is one of the great 20th century
writers.
You
admire very much, yeah.
Oh, I do. Yeah. Yeah, I really do. He holds up.
He's also called an allegorist, and you would...
And he also hated allegory and said so quite strongly.
Of course, so is Hawthorne. So are a lot of writers, I suppose.
Hawthorne really did write allegories. I think he set out to. And I think Tolkien and I would prefer to think of ourselves as slightly more complicated, even if we aren't.
Well, you've said that you believe words are acts. Tell me what you mean by that. I mean, if you still subscribe to that ideal.
Because they have effects. I mean, if an action is something that causes an effect, words are very powerful actions. They have to be not only spoken, they have to be listened to. So it's a kind of collaborative act, the written word particularly, of course. The reader has to accept it and take it in.
Do you think of a reader? Do you have a reader in mind?
No. That would be fatal if I had a reader in mind. But I have... When I'm writing, I'm not doing anything but writing. I'm just following the story. But when I think about it afterwards, I have come increasingly to realize that writing is a collaborative act and that what I write is nothing until the reader reads it. And they make it come alive. And this is both, it's kind of humbling and frightening, but it's very exciting, too, to realize, you know, that I'm writing just one book, but every reader that reads it is going to make a different book out of it. That's neat.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Yeah. Do you like, in fact, meeting? I mean, you have many passionate readers. Do you like meeting them and hearing what they have to say?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So it's an education in many ways, I suspect, isn't it?
Yeah.
And fun.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, we're going to continue having both an education and fun with Ursula Le Guin. Let me invite you to join us. You can do that now if you have questions or comments for our guest. We're at 415-863-2476. Her new novel is called The Telling, and you're cordially invited to participate in this conversation again at 415-863-2476. And I've been asked to announce this evening's event at the Unitarian Center here at Franklin at Geary. I'm going to be talking with Ursula Le Guin. Different conversation we'll have on stage, sponsored by Clean, Well-Lighted Place. And if you're interested in tickets, the number in the 415 area code is 863-3136. That's 415-863-3136. If you're interested in joining us now and becoming part of this conversation, we're at 415-863-2476. And we'll continue and take your phone calls when we return. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny talking with Ursula Le Guin, who is laughing because showing her a photograph that was taken.
That's wonderful.
You want to describe that? Use your writer's it's beyond description.
It's this hippie with a beard. Is there a beard? It's droopy mustache.
It's a droopy mustache. It's me many years
a
ago.
A long
droopy
mustache.
When I was right out of graduate school.
Wild-eyed.
With a card. It should be in the Smithsonian. They don't even make these cards anymore, these punch cards. Yeah.
That's right. Fold, bend, staple, or mutilate.
Exactly. Yeah. Let's take your calls. Diamond Dave is first up here. Good morning.
Hey, Ursula, it's really good. I've been reading you for, it seems like, generations. And what I've always wanted to ask you, and every time I see the Corbett Museum in Berkeley, I think about it, is the degree in which anthropological kind of techniques are applied in your work, which you may or may not have inherited through your parents, who through your parents open up the whole Native American spirit, the Native American tradition, and how does, to what degree the spirit of Ishi lives through you in your work. I remember particularly a work you did. I don't remember the title, but which you also included a cassette of music of the people that you had invented.
That's always coming home. Yeah.
And I'd really love to talk about, you to talk a bit about anthropology, the spirit of your parents, the spirit of Ishi, and how it lives through your work.
Well, you've just said earlier it comes through the unconscious, doesn't it, largely, or in your work?
Unless anthropology is genetic, which I somehow doubt, it's kind of got to be an osmosis thing. Yeah. I guess it's kind of a, you know, it's sort of a mindset of just being interested in the way people of another society, another culture think, and just being interested in the fact that people from other cultures think differently from the way we do. And instead of finding this unacceptable or uncomfortable, finding it exciting and stimulating and wanting to know how they think.
And I think you've really, this is really passed on to several generations now of imagination, of freewheeling and freestyling and thought. And I think we can see it politically and culturally. And much of what you've done has animated not only the spirit of science fiction, but I think free spirits everywhere.
Well, thank you.
I think a lot of, you mentioned the hippie movement. I think a lot of the hippie movement originated in intelligent, voracious readers when they were adolescents who read you.
Well,
thank you, Dave.
All right. I started the 60s, hey.
Personally responsible. You're going to be accountable for that, too. Speaking about Ishi, do you have strong feelings about all this? I mean, it's very much in the news again about, you know, where the museum's giving up, for example, the rights to brains and other parts of for sacred burial and so
forth. They just had a symposium at UC Berkeley called Who Owns the Body?
Yeah.
A very big, important question, which I think that symposium started as a discussion of this whole moral problem about Ishi's remains, which, you know, a vexed and miserable subject, and spread out to Chile and Bosnia and so on. I mean, the fact of what happens to bodies and what happens to people who are disappeared, who are literally dismembered and so on. This is a big and scary subject.
You mentioned disappeared, and in your writing, you use that same word about feminist exclusionists and, for example, those who say that you can't be a feminist if you're heterosexual. You say they want you disappeared?
They want you to disappear, yes. Yes.
Not the same kind of disappearance.
No, I don't like to use the verb disappeared, to be disappeared. I don't like to use that lightly because its resonance is so terrible from South America.
Yes, Argentina especially. Yeah. Mark, join us from Menlo Park. Good morning.
Hi, I'm a longtime science fiction reader, in part thanks to Miss Le Guin and The Lathe of Heaven, which I read every year, whether I need it or not. And I wanted to ask about Left-Handed Darkness. I was really pleased to see Lathe of Heaven on PBS for the first time in 20 years, which I had fragmentary memories of. And comment and a question about Left-Handed Darkness. One is, has it ever been optioned as a screenplay, and will it ever appear as on screen? And is the thanks because it's made every bus ride since interesting, because every time I see someone with ambiguous characteristics in their face or their haircut or whatever, I think, boy, I'd like to put them on the list as a cast member for Left-Handed Darkness.
Yeah, there are lots of Gathenians around, aren't there?
Yeah.
You don't realize how many to you.
And they all
seem
to ride the subway and the train.
Yeah, many are here in San Francisco, in fact. But you did write a screenplay once of Left-Handed Darkness, didn't you?
Yeah, I've written a screenplay. I think another one's been written. Michael Powell... No, he did Earthsea. Left Hand's been optioned several times and never got off the ground. It is it would be a big, expensive, ambitious movie because of the snow, the ice, and the androgynous people.
Yeah.
But it sure would, I think it would make a really pretty movie. I wish somebody would get the guts to do it.
They make a wonderful movie, and I thank the caller. The association, of course, is so strong with gender with that novel, but I also think about the idea of foretelling the future, which is a very important part of the novel, as I recall it, and how you play with that and make us see, to some extent, the power of perhaps not being able to tell the future.
Yeah, yeah. And it's kind of playing back and forth with the fact that these people apparently can foretell but don't want to and do it as seldom as possible. Yeah.
More of your calls. Don, you're on with us from Mountain View. Good morning. Welcome.
Hi. In the book, Always Coming Home, there's a part of that where the humans are sort of given over all the technology and the science over to the machines. And I personally found that very upsetting. I actually stopped reading it the first time. I came back recently and finished reading it. But it just seems like that's such a human part of me to want to learn more about science and technology. So I just wondered why you came up with that as sort of an extrapolation.
Well, I wouldn't describe it quite that way. I'm showing a very small group, a small society, small culture, who have chosen a technologically extremely advanced, simplified way of life. I mean, technology doesn't just mean what they invented last year. These people have washing machines and wouldn't do without them. They have printing. They do not choose to plunge into the sea of information the way we at the moment have chosen to do. And I think part of the point I was making, and I wrote that book just at the beginning of this, the big expansion of information via the net, the web, electronic information. I think I was kind of saying, look, we're going one way, but there are other ways to go. You don't have to buy into it just because they invented it last year. And this is not a very fashionable stance, and it may be a kind of wrong-headed one, but I still defend it because I think that's one of the things science fiction does. The important things that science fiction does, however it does it, is always to offer options, always to say, okay, we're doing something, we're living this way. This is not the way you have to live. There are other ways to live.
Is there a little of the neo-Luddite in you, do you think?
I mean, no. Because what there is a kind of a, I keep wanting to say, but technology doesn't mean a technology that destroys its planet in order to exist. We have an incredibly exploitive technology. There are, what I was trying to imagine in Always Coming Home was a steady state technology, put it that way, instead of the myth of progress, which we have bought into heart and soul and are destroying the planet. I mean, if to say that is Luddite, then I don't like that word. Because Luddite just means you go out and wreck machines. I don't want to wreck machines. I love my iBook, you know. But I realize what my iBook costs indirectly in the way of rainforest. I mean, we have to think about these things, and science fiction is one way.
In the new novel, you have a kind of secular terrorism that's wrought by largely what could be described as techno-corporate types.
Myth of progress.
Yeah, in the name of progress.
Progress becomes a cult. It has become a kind of cult with us. Look, we have to keep, the market has to keep expanding, doesn't it? I mean, capitalism is based on constant growth. If you don't grow, you're dead. This doesn't work for bodies.
I think
possibly goldfish, but not human beings. If we keep growing, we're dead.
I like E. Cummings' line, progress, a comfortable disease.
Yeah, beautiful.
And Jennifer from Fremont, hi, you're on the air with us. Good morning.
Hi, thanks. I'm disappointed right now that I won't be able to attend the conversation tonight because I'll be attending class at San Jose State where Ms. Le Guin taught a semester last.
Give my love to San Jose State, please.
And I was just wondering, I'm also disappointed that I didn't get to take your class, but I was wondering how teaching influenced you as a writer or in any other way.
How teaching did?
Yes.
It makes you get your ideas in order in the first place because, you have to at least sound as if you knew what you were talking about when you teach. And then it's being in contact with younger people and people who are coming into a field for the first time and have that excitement and so on. It's there is a constant refreshment.
You enjoy it?
Teaching. Oh, yeah. Love it. Yeah.
Jennifer, thank you. And you obviously loved teaching in San Jose State from the
South. I did, yeah.
How did that come about? How did they find you, or you find them? Or
The Lurys gave them a lovely hunk of money to the English department to buy professors with.
The Bob Lurys? Yeah, from the old ownership.
So I was the first Lurey professor in the English department. And I could alter my card so it said I was the first Lurey professor. But it was a lot of fun.
Talking to the Lurey professor, Ursula Le Guin, and more of your calls. Ted joining us from Boulder Creek. Hi, Ted.
Hi. It's great. I'm glad to be on. I'd like to thank Ms. Le Guin for all of her books. The Earthsea Trilogy was just fabulous. I read it as a young person. It affected my life, as did Heinlein and Asimov and others. I found myself working as the executive director for National Aviation Reporting Center on anomalous phenomena. So when Ms. Le Guin talks about options, the mental exercises that prepare us for dealing with trying to understand what's going on around us, it's very important to have those drills, and they should be in society and in our culture and available to us. I have a son who's 14, and once again, those writings and studies affect how his mind is exercised and the directions that we are able to go in. If you ask me what I do, I work on aviation safety issues, but the real fundamental of it is trying to understand what I strongly feel is an extraterrestrial intelligence, and it's those type of exercises that make those possibilities available to us where we might be faced with something that is just beyond us otherwise.
I'm just wondering, Ursula Le Guin, do you keep up with this kind of exploration of stellar space and search for extraterrestrial life? And is that something that, you know, you continue to read up on or not?
I try to keep abreast, but it's not, I'm not a hound on it. I would like to just enlarge on what our caller just said to, and expand that to all fiction. Every serious novel presents an alternative world to the reader. In other words, it puts him in somebody else's skin, and you try being Jane Eyre or any Uncle Tom. You try being people. You find out what it is like to be other people, and it's the same kind of mind stretching. It's the same kind of, in a sense, offering an alternative life to the reader, which I think is really important. It's what we're talking about, isn't it? Is training the imagination, just a basic training, like exercises, like stretching exercises.
The art of empathy, maybe.
I'm sorry.
The art of empathy, learning to empathize.
Art of empathy, or actually just sort of being in somebody else's skin, so you forget that you're you and you think you're Jane Eyre for the moment.
And you can find a perspective that you perhaps wouldn't have seen
exactly.
Otherwise. And it's very valuable in my work.
I think it's essential for all children should have
this. And this is where the reader and writer become collaborators, as you suggested earlier, in the creation of
because
this
world. Because the reader has to sort of accept being this person. And sometimes it's difficult. I mean, it's not easy for me often to accept being some of the characters in some of the novels I read. I don't want to suffer that much, or I don't want to be that mean or something.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank the caller. I had said before we went on the air that Akka, of course, first made me think of also known as, but secondly, of Nabokov's novel Ada, because that's also, that's his one foray into science fiction, trying to create an alternate world was really what that was all about.
I've never read it.
Well,
shame.
No, not important. I mean, I never read Dorothy Bryant, who you mentioned when we were off the air either. I held my head in shame, and she's a local writer, but I'm going to read her. But the only reason I mention this is that sense of, again, creating another world, and you are in charge. You are the one who pares your fingernails, to quote Joyce, and creates the world and becomes the creator, sole proprietor.
Except you're not.
But then the collaboration with the reader.
Yeah, right.
Lisa is our next caller from Menlo Park. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I wanted to bounce off something that you guys were saying earlier about Harry Potter. When I read the first one, I was shocked at how much it reminded me, especially in the beginning of Ged's adventures in The Wizard of Earthsea, and that nobody was commenting on that. And I wanted to tell everyone I knew who liked Harry Potter, go read Wizard of Earthsea.
Thank you.
But I think that the Harry Potter books are just missing, they're fun, but they're missing those great truths that we find in the Earthsea trilogy. And I'm going to read a quote of yours to yourself, Ms. Le Guin. I have a book that I like to write my favorite passages from books in, and this is fairly short. You write in The Farthest Shore, "Having intelligence, we must not act in ignorance. Having choice, we must not act without responsibility. Do nothing because it is righteous or praiseworthy or notable to do so. Do nothing because it seems good to do so. Do only that which you must do and which you cannot do in any other way. And I think that speaks to a lot of what you've been saying here today. And I also wanted to say I'm a seventh grade teacher, and I've used Those Who Walk Away from Omelas as a wonderful story to read to children and get them to just start thinking about perspective and responsibility and heroes and, you know, what goodness is and what the prices are that we pay for the things that we have. And it's
wonderful. Does that story make some of them cross?
Yes.
Yeah,
I get very angry students. You bet I do. I get very angry.
Because there's no answer at the end, yeah.
Right, and they fight amongst themselves sometimes, but they continue talking about it afterwards, which is, I think, the best thing.
Yeah,
that's
so
great.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call. Your work is philosophical, almost, and I mean, just gleaning from what that caller was saying. I mean, you're more a philosopher than an anthropologist in many ways, aren't you?
Oh, I never could read philosophy. I think narratively. I'm a storyteller.
But the philosophy comes through the story. The philosophy is embedded in the story.
The little quote she just read, of course, that wasn't exactly me talking. That was, you know, a wizard in a book giving instructions to a younger person.
But your character, of course.
Yeah, I made them both up.
Yeah.
Now, the younger one may not follow those directions very, very adequately. I have to dodge under the philosopher label.
You don't
label.
Like philosopher label.
I can't. No. I really, my mind does not work abstractly. And philosophy is an abstract discipline. And my mind works only concretely. And really, in order to think, I have to turn it into a story. That's what I did in the telling, you see, was I had to tell this story so I could understand this thing that had sort of appalled me so.
Wisdom comes through the story, though, and wisdom is often seen as the search for what philosophy, the fruits of philosophy, I guess.
Yeah. And telling stories is certainly a very, very, very important survival tactic for human beings. We have to be able to make sense out of things. And I think one of the absolutely basic ways we do it is turning them into a story. And if we can't, then we feel like we're losing hold on reality, or we're going mad, or the world is, you know, it becomes opaque.
They're vital. I think, in fact, I'll read a quote of yours. We won't say this is philosophical sounding, but I doubt that the imagination can be suppressed. If you truly eradicated it in a child, he would grow up to be an eggplant.
Yes, I still agree with that.
Xavier joins us from Brookdale. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Yeah, it's a great show. I wanted to, I've got a comment and a question I'm going to mix together. You were talking earlier about technology, and something that I'm interested in is lasers, high voltage, fuel cells, alternative energy, and I'm thinking about teaching children, school-age children, about technology, and particularly encouraging women who are interested into not being intimidated by it. The comments that I had is earlier I was listening to you mention something about testosterone levels in, I think it was Harvard or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I cringe when I hear that because, you know, I hear a lot of feminists wanting to be CEOs, and I want to encourage more feminist movement to encourage women to support men who want to stay home and take care of the kids. And I just wanted
to hear
your thoughts on maybe some guidance because I'm going into this thing with teaching children. Any ideas you might have about that?
Oh, I think you're doing something extremely brave and something that will probably make you feel defeated half the time, because isn't it true that, in a sense, you're trying to send girls, talking particularly about your girl students, into a world which was established a long time ago in a very male-dominated culture and which hasn't changed that much. And we're, you know, we are changing it, but the changes are slow and painful, and they're hard on individuals. I mean, some of these girls are going to love the technology, they're going to love what they learn,
yeah.
And then they're going to kind of go out in the world and find that nobody wants them.
Well, the thing that I'm wanting to do is get away from this kind of first-year women's studies student mentality of being, like, angry at men and teaching women that it's okay to be technologically minded, and you don't have to be so militant about it. It's just, it should be a comfortable thing that okay, I'm here and there's no problem with it, you know?
Yeah, but wouldn't that be nice if it were so? But the one reason the kids are angry is that they know it isn't so.
Yeah.
Maybe in your classroom it's going to be great, and that's good because anger is only fruitful up to a point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you, Xavier. And next caller is Patrick from Oakland. Good morning.
Morning. Hi. I read the Earthsea trilogy a couple of years ago. I liked that tremendously. And I think one of your short stories many years ago, so I haven't read a lot of what you've written. But one thing I got out of that was that you, in those books, you present a really positive view of human and personal transformation in people's lives. And I contrast this with other science fiction, which has a very negative and cynical view of the future. And I think of the movie Blade Runner or the movie The Matrix, or there's other literature written in that vein. And I'm wondering if you have felt drawn toward, I mean, do you feel that you have to give a positive message, or maybe some of the other books are more cynical and negative? And I'll take this offline.
All right. Thank you for the call. Ursula Le Guin.
Well, of course, the Earthsea books are not science fiction. They're fantasy, which is a kind of different game with quite different rules. And the kind of science fiction you're talking about is this sort of noir science fiction, which has been quite fashionable lately, which I'm not very good at writing. But my science fiction futures are full of pain and trouble, but I wouldn't say that they're uniformly bleak and grim. But science fiction is, you know, once you start talking about the future, it always gets a little bit scary.
What do you think of, have you seen these films he mentions, like Blade Runner? And,
yeah, I saw Blade Runner.
And Matrix?
Didn't see Matrix. My problem with Blade Runner was that I'm very fond of the novel that it was supposed to be based on, and I thought it was kind of a travesty of Phil Dick's novel. But apparently Phil liked it okay. He saw it just before he died, so who am I to complain?
What other science fiction writers have you been particularly drawn to?
Oh, gosh. A lot of them. Just most of my contemporaries, really, you know. And I came into science fiction in a kind of an exciting generation with other women. We sort of all moved in and said, hey, we're young and some of us are women and we're going to remake this genre. And we kind of did.
Still has a kind of male hegemony to it, though, doesn't it? Most of the men, it's about most of the science fiction writers are
male.
Associated with men, yeah.
I think it's about, yeah, well, as always, all the awards in literature, you know, literature is about half female and the awards about three quarters to men. I don't know why the prizes always go to the guys. This is troublesome.
Well, you've won a few yourself.
I won lots of prizes.
Yeah. Indeed.
In science fiction, it's actually less true. I think there's more equity. I counted prizes a couple of years ago, like the Booker Awards and those things. And science fiction did pretty well for gender equality.
Ursula Le Guin, always a delight to talk to you. Thank you for being with us. Again, her new novel is The Telling, and we'll be together again tonight at 8 o'clock if you'd like to come and see us at Clean, Well-Lighted Place for Books. The number for tickets is 415-863-3136. That's at 8 o'clock. Our thanks to our producers. Forum is produced by Robin Giannatasio-Mall, Judy Campbell, and Eric Jansen. And our interns are Naomi Marcus, Annie Baxter, Mary Kay Hardwick, Lisa Lindeleff, Ron Siegel, and Martha Wallner. And our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. From KQED-FM in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.